North Hollywood, California, and I'm sitting in the office of Jimmy Fidler, and there's not a movie star picture in sight. I thought it would be covered in autographed pictures of the stars. Is that how you get out of playing favorites, Jimmy Fidler?
Well, no, I've got lots of pictures of the stars in my files and so on that I've had ever since 1919, when I first came to Hollywood. I don't hang them in here. You see, most of these things on the walls were done by my daughters in school. And while they're pretty amateurish, they're my daughters.
You came to Hollywood in 1919. Where were you from?
At that time, I came from Memphis, Tennessee. But just before that, I had been in the services. I was a Marine Corps debit. What do you call them? Debit. Not an asset, a debit. And in the Marine Corps, I had been watching movies every Friday. That was the only thing we had to do then. No television, no radio, and so on. And I decided I wanted to be a movie star, so I came out in 1919 after I was mustered out and got a few jobs as extra, won a beauty contest, so-called, with one of the movie magazines, but I nearly starved to death trying to be an actor, so I quit along about 1920, got out of it. Wasn't my type of fish, as they say, or can of fish, or what is it, they say, can of beer. I'm just talking away. Is this going on? Are you using
sure,
all
no,
this?
Yes,
oh,
sure.
Well, you interrupt me once in a while. Let me catch a breath of air. You go now.
No, I was interested in did you go into publicity then after you gave up the idea of becoming a movie star?
No, I didn't. I didn't go right into publicity. I became a press agent for Grauman's Theaters. Sid Grauman had the Million Dollar and two other theaters in. I became a press agent in a sort of a flunky role. And being fairly imaginative, I pulled off some good stunts so that I became chief press agent for the Million Dollar. And while I was there, Grauman used to put on these prologues that were famous all over the world. A lot of other theaters did them later, but Sid Grauman innovated them. And I was press agenting one of these prologues when the managing editor of a forthcoming new paper in Hollywood called the Hollywood News approached me and asked me if I'd like to work for him, be the movie editor for the Hollywood News. I took the job, and it paid me $22 and a half a week, which then was pretty fair money, but not big money. And the Hollywood News was not really a newspaper. It was an insert for the old Los Angeles Express. You subscribed to the Express in the Hollywood area, and they gave you the Hollywood News free. And our rival paper out there, the Citizen, used to call us an insert, which infuriated us, of course. Well, excuse me. I was the drama editor and motion picture editor for about a year and a half, and then the city editor quit. And I became city editor and drama editor and just about everything else. And it was about this time that the big scandals began hitting Hollywood. The Fatty Arbuckle death of the girl up in San Francisco, the Wally Reed dope case, the Wanda Hawley case, the William Desmond Taylor, Mary Miles Minter, Mabel Norman case. One after another, these big scandals hit, and I was, as a city editor, I was always a crusader anyway, began a crusade to clean up Hollywood. And I wrote front page articles and gave over the whole front page to this thing. And meanwhile, something I forgot was that I was, before this was all happening, I had started the first Hollywood column, which I did by taking my Hollywood News page, my drama page, and throwing out all of the extraneous and local stuff and using the national stuff to make a two-column syndicated form, or whatever you want to call it, which I would do myself out in the printing room. They didn't have unions then. And you could go out and run your own proofs. And so I'd run off proofs and send them out. And I had amassed a total of 10 stations who were paying me $10 a month. I'm getting $100 a month for this and $22.50 from the paper. $22.50 a week from the paper. But when the scandals hit, all of my papers canceled. And not one of them paid me. Not one of my papers ever paid me for it. The scandal hit shortly after I started it. But anyway, on the strength of this series of articles I was doing and the sensation it created, our circulation jumped like mad. And one day I got a call to come over to Paramount. And you asked me when I started press agenting. This is the story. And I went over and I was called into the head office of the head of the publicity department. And he said he wanted to hire me and for his department at a salary of $75 a week. Well, of course, as I told you, I was getting, well, by this time, my salary had gone up to about $30 for the paper. And I accepted, and of course I was just a rank kid at the time. I was just in my early 20s. And I thought I was being called over as because of my bright writing and my good ideas and so on and so forth. Well, my first day on the new job, they called me in and they said, the head of the department, Adam Hull Shirk, said that I was to be assigned to Gloria Swanson. Well, of course, my head puffed up much bigger because Gloria was then the big star. And here I was, the newcomer to publicity, and I was going to handle Gloria. And I went into the outer office from his office. And in those days, press agents didn't have individual offices. They were in one big city room like a newspaper. And I announced to my neighbor at the next desk, but loudly enough to be heard all over, that I had been assigned to Gloria Swanson. And expecting to hear a lot of O's and A's, and I heard the O's all right, but it seems that the O's were caused by the fact that the last five people ahead of me to handle Gloria had lost their jobs because of inability to handle Gloria. Well, immediately I saw what was happening. I had been called over from my job on the newspaper where I'd been hammering these stars and scandals, all of whom were stars connected with Paramount Studio, it so happened. That whole bunch were all under contract to Paramount. And I'd been brought over out of my job. I was no longer with the paper. The scandal series stopped. And I'd been assigned Gloria Swanson, so within a week or two, they figured I'd be fired. And it was all plain as day. Well, I went home that night scared to death. I came down next morning at 5 o'clock, and I sat on the stairway to Gloria's dressing room, a bungalow, waiting for her to come in. Sure enough, pretty soon she came down with her entourage of a chauffeur and a couple of maids, a makeup woman, a little army following her, bigger than Arnold Palmer's army. And she came down and she looked at me and said, yes. And I said, Miss Swanson, my name is Jimmy Fiddler, and I've been with the Hollywood News. She said, yes, I've been reading your articles. And she said, well, I've been brought over here to a job over here, and the first job they gave me was publicity man for Gloria Swanson, and I was highly honored until I found out that the last five men who handled you lost their job, and I need my job, and I want to come down and get your help. Well, this little round-faced guy that I was must have appealed to the mother in her, although she wasn't much older than I was. So she called me in, and she promised me cooperation, and she was just magnificent. From then on, I got everything they wanted. She stopped production on Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, which was the picture she was making, for half a day to make set stills, which she had never done. She stayed in the studio photography department two different nights till 1 o'clock in the morning taking photographs, publicity, which she had never done, and which she didn't do again because for the two following years, they were still using the same photographs to publicize Swanson. And she was just magnificent. Well, of course, that my job was saved, and they couldn't very well fire me then. And I had done such a good job with her, as she had done such a good job with me, let's put it, that I was in pretty good shape with the boys from then on. And she was wonderful from then on. From that time on, she was so nice to me. She came to my rescue a couple of times when things came up. And she made a personal appearance tour with her picture, Zsa Zsa, I think that was the name, yes, which she had made in Europe after she had married the Count over there, Henri de la Folie. And my mother wrote me a letter and said Gloria was coming there to appear at the Orpheum Theater, and she would so much like to meet her because I had told my mother about what she had done, what Gloria had done for me. And I wired Gloria in Nashville, Tennessee, which was a stop ahead of Memphis, and told her that my mother wanted to meet her and thank her for being good to her son, and would she please give her that privilege. Well, Gloria sent her limousine for my mother. She gave her a front seat in the theater. She brought her back into her dressing room, took her to dinner, and took her home. And anybody who ever tells me that Gloria Swanson is not a right person, I'm going to shoot him or her right on the dot. She was great. Now your turn.
Well, I didn't. How long were you with Gloria Swanson then?
Well, not terribly long, because after she made Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, she made a picture on location, and I was assigned to the studio, and I did not go on location. And then she went overseas and married the Count. And so I was not assigned to her except for the one picture and part of another one. And the other one was Beyond the Rocks, which she did with Valentino, But the reason I was with her on that was actually not just because it was a sponsored picture and she wouldn't have anybody else, but because at the time, the entire studio press agent department, publicity department, was out with the flu. That was the first big flu epidemic to hit Hollywood. And I was the only man who wasn't afflicted. Everybody was out. I was all alone in that department. So I had to handle everybody, including not only Gloria, but Pola Negri, her arch enemy, who had just come over, and they were the two queens, one of Europe, one of America, and I had to handle the two of them. And you may believe me, this was no easy job.
Were they really enemies? I always wondered if that was publicity.
They were enemies. No, that was not publicity. They were bitter enemies. In fact, Gloria said at one time, and this was not publicity, that if Pola Negri came on that lot, she would not set foot on the studio grounds at all. But she was in the middle of this picture when Pola came over, this Beyond the Rocks. So she had to stay and finish it, but you know something? She had her chauffeur drive up to the door, to the gate of the studio. She'd get out, and she had somebody in a wheelchair take her to her dressing room and wheelchair her to the studio stage that she was working on, and she did not set foot on that studio ground. She kept her word. She didn't. She was in her dressing room and on stage, but not on the studio.
What was their quarrel, do you remember?
Oh, I think it was just a double jealousy between two people who really didn't know each other. But they had built up Pola coming over so much that Gloria, I'm sure, was jealous of her, and she was going to hang on to her. But she was a little like Luana Parsons, who used to get mad at people who didn't tell her first. They didn't say, "I'll tell you first." Luella would get mad at him and spank him in her column. Well, Gloria was a queen, and she was going to remain the queen, and did.
Did you have dealings with Miss Parsons and Hedda Hopper before you became a columnist?
As a publicity
man? Mm-hmm.
Neither one of them were out here. Neither one of them was out here. Luella was in New York doing a column for the Hearst paper there. And Hedda didn't become a columnist until, years and years later. I knew Hedda as an actress, but just knew her. But she didn't become a columnist until, 20 years after this, 20 or 25 years later.
So you were long before either one of them, really.
Well, I had the first Hollywood column, the one that I told you about, that went out of business when the scandals hit, and I never started another one. But I was out here, I think Luella came out about 1927 or 28, along in there. I'm not exactly sure, but I know it was quite a few years afterwards. And it was in the late, very late 20s, I guess it was. And she came out, and as a press agent, of course, I had dealings with her then. My job was to get things printed, and anything you got printed in Luella Parsons' column was worth everything you could get printed everywhere else. This is the Hollywood way. What the star or the producer can read in a column in the morning over his coffee is important. And especially if it was Hopper and later if it was, Parsons, and later if it was Hopper or Parsons. And I could get, as my clients, I could get them 2 inches in Parsons' column and the same story, a half a column on Associated Press and 400 newspapers over the country. The Parsons' column item was the important one. In their minds, that is.
Yeah. How did you get on with them once you were on the radio and the other two, the ladies, were on the radio, too?
Very well. I always managed to get along with all of them. Walter Winchell and I were quite friends, quite good friends. He was good to me in many ways and helped me in many ways. And I got along very well with all of them until a certain period when Lolly was down on me for a while, and that was when she was doing Hollywood Hotel. And she was the mistress of ceremonies on it, interviewed a star, and gave a little Hollywood gossip. And the songbird on that program was a girl named Frances Langford, whom you doubtless remember. She's a beautiful singer and still is, although she married a very rich man and practically retired from any active life. She was a star singer of Hollywood Hotel. And one Sunday, I got a phone call. One Sunday morning, I got a phone call from some anonymous person whom I never did learn who it was, who said that Frances Langford and John Hall, he was a star too, had eloped to Arizona and been married. And they had escaped the attention of all the newspapers and everybody. And this was, I say, was a Sunday morning. And he gave me the, I said, how do I know and where did they go to? And he told me where they'd gone, where they'd been married, whose car they'd gone in. It was John's sister's car that they'd gone down in to escape notice. The license number of the car, even. So it must have been somebody close to the family. Well, I started checking. I found out that that car had crossed the border because at that time they were checking all license numbers for the immigration, not the immigration, but the agriculture department of Arizona and coming this way, California. Found out that they had gone to Phoenix, got a hold of a reporter in Phoenix and told him if he could get the story on the quiet for me, I'd send him $100. He got to the Justice of Peace, came back with the story. They had been married, when and where and so on and so forth, and got back to me just shortly before I was going on the air that Sunday night. Well, to double verify it, I called Francis on the phone. And I said, Francis, Jimmy Fiddler, and I want to call you, talk to you about your marriage. Oh, she said, Luella had it this morning on the front page of the Examiner. We're going to be married at Christmas. And this was in November. And Luella, sure enough, that morning, on the front page of the Examiner, had this big story, John and Francis would be married at Christmas. And I said, yes, I saw that story, but I'm not calling you about Christmas. I'm calling you about your marriage in Arizona yesterday. She said, you're crazy. I'm not married. I said, listen, Francis, Luella will kill you if you don't phone her and say, Luella, I want you to be the first to know I was married to John Hall yesterday in Phoenix. Now, Luella always listens to my program. So I'm calling you to pay you the courtesy of calling Luella and telling her that you were married. And now, this is 5 minutes before my show. This couldn't hurt me, you know. That you were married yesterday in Arizona. Well, she thanked me and said it was true. That she had been and said I had all the facts right. And this gave her time to call Luella. And so Luella had it first, even though I had it 5 minutes later on my program. She didn't have any program at that time, or at least not on the air. Not my type of show. So that's the story of how Luella was mad at me for a while, but she didn't stay mad. We became good friends, and Hedda and I were good friends. And as a matter of fact, when I was running the National Kids Day Foundation and was part of the Kiwanis group out here gathering money for the foundation, both Luella and Hedda gave me pretty good-sized checks for our Kiwanis club out here. So we were that friendly.
You mentioned some of the scandals that broke during the days of silent films. I don't know whether you know this or not, but fans have it in their mind that there are all kinds of delicious scandals that happen out here that absolutely are never known. Is that true? Have you known stories? I'm not asking you to tell them, but do you know stories that you've never broken?
Yes and no. I mean by that yes and no, I know, let us say, of misbehaviors that you wouldn't break. Now, here's what I mean by that. Let us say that a star and a man are married. And it comes to my attention or my knowledge that the man is playing around with another girl, which is a rather common thing here and in Podunk and in Paris and in England and everywhere. Now then, I don't break that story. But I do watch that marriage because almost inevitably the wife finds out about these things. If this is the first one, there's another one or another one, and she finds out. And we're keeping such a close eye on that marriage that usually we were the first ones to know that when the trouble was coming. The wife would go away on some pretext for 2 or 3 weeks on a trip without the husband. This is a tip-off. Then we're free to go loose and break a rumor that there's trouble in the household. And from that rumor, break the story when it comes. And if the story breaks in the papers, we could go back and say, well, as we told you 2 weeks ago, blah, 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 and so on, have divorced or are divorcing. So this is a matter of checking. All in a reporter's life, checking and chasing down clues is much like a detective's life. It's a big part of his business. Many of our baby stories came from doctor's offices and baby clinics and nurses working in those offices whom we paid for information. If it was a big star, we'd pay $100 for a good tip. If a Loretta Young or a big star, I'm going back a few years to that time, if a big star was going to have a baby and the doctor's office had taken a rabbit test or a frog test and gotten an affirmative, that nurse would rush down to us and we'd come out with a story. I don't know whether any other reporters followed this scheme or not, but it paid off well for others. I don't believe the others did, because if they did, they would have had more scoops than we got. But we got a lot of stories this way. I got a lot of news stories on the air from anonymous people. I live in Toluca Lake, as I think I told you earlier, before we started airing this stuff. And one day in my mailbox, which was in the wall on the outside of the property, there was a little scribbled note that if I would check in San Bernardino, California, I would find that a girl named Mulligan had married a certain man whose name I forget right at the present. I would get a story. Well, Mulligan was one of the Lane sisters. Which one escapes my mind right now? There were four of them, but anyway, one of the Lane sisters, a Priscilla. And the man she had married, the other man, whose name was given me, was an assistant director at Warner Brothers Studio. And I checked up in San Bernardino. I sent a reporter up there by car. He checked into the files, and sure enough, that marriage had taken place. And the man who gave me the story, or the woman who gave me the story by writing the scribble note, had also said that the man she had married had just been divorced in Arizona, so I had checked that also while the thing was being checked up in San Bernardino. So I had the story on the air, naturally, and nobody knew anything about it. But Priscilla Lane, who was then quite a big star, the Lane sisters, had been married to this assistant director, and I don't know to this day where the tip came from. Just somebody that either liked my gossip or, you know, lots of people like to tell something and then hear it. Lots of people have the gossip urge, and they only wish they were in the newspaper business or the radio business so they could do their gossip loudly. So they can't, so they tell me, or they would tell Parsons, or they tell Hopper. Today there are no others doing it except me, so they have me only to tell. But they love to go and tell their gossip. And then I suppose have the satisfaction of hearing it on the air, because otherwise, why would they give me a tip anonymously when they'd have no axe to grind? And I'd assume there's no axe to grind when they mention that somebody's going to be married. Of course, it could be, too. I will take it back. There could have been an axe to grind. At this time, I was not welcome at the Warner Brothers studio, because I had broadcast something that Jack Warner didn't like, and they had put out the blackball. I couldn't get into the studio. This happened with all studios eventually, and here and there, not all at once, luckily. And during that time that I was on the blacklist, I got more Warner Brothers studio stories from people working there who also didn't happen to like some of the Warner people than I ever got when I was had free entree to the lot. Much, many more. So it could be possible that this came from one of those people who wanted to take a little slap at the Warners and wanted me to get it.
You're the first, aren't you the first Hollywood columnist to go on actually on the air? Do you have a radio program?
Yes, yes.
When did that start?
That started in 1930, actually in 1932. I was at that time, I'd quit publicity. I'd grown sick of it. I'd lost a lot of money in the stock market crash between 29 and 31. I'd been quite well-to-do, and I was practically wiped out, and I had a nervous breakdown as a result of all this, and I came back, and I just didn't have the fortitude, I guess you'd call it, the guts, to go back into publicity. I didn't like it. There was too much bowing and kowtowing and begging for your monthly checks from your clients and so on, and I didn't like it. It wasn't my idea of life. So I went into magazine writing and was pretty successful at it, and primarily, as I told you, because I had lots of ideas, and I imagined, as they still do, I presume, about half of what I wrote. Well, in 1932, there was a program on the air, presumably an unsponsored show, called Hollywood on the Air. Now, this wasn't like Hollywood Hotel, Parsons. This was Hollywood on the Air, and it consisted of music and skits from plays, pictures that RKO was making. So while, as I say, they called it an unsponsored program, it was really for the benefit of RKO Pictures. and Sarnoff owned both RKO and the Blue and Red Network. So it was a family affair. Well, they decided they had worn out the formula, format of the show, so they decided to put on interviews, star interviews. And the first person that they were going to interview, that they chose to interview, was Dorothy Jordan, who was not a big star, but who was the wife of Miriam Cooper, who was the head of RKO Studio, and this was a matter of protocol. It was the thing to do to get the wife of the head man the first interview. She was a lovely person and quite a nice little actress. Well, she and I came from the same end of Tennessee. That is the west end of Tennessee, and we were old Tennesseans, and as such, we're good friends. So she called me and asked me if I would like to do the interview, because they were going to have somebody do it, and I said, yes, I'd like it. Well, we did it. And undoubtedly, as many bad things as I've ever done on radio in my life, this was the worst. We were both scared to death. We both stumbled through this thing. I had no voice training, and she had some, but this was in the days when silent pictures were just going out and talking pictures were just coming in. So she wasn't too well trained, and it was horrible. But as a result of it, I got about 400 letters in the next few days, and she got over 2,000. So I got to thinking this thing over, and I thought, well, gee, if anything that bad could bring in that much mail, it had potential. And Walter Winchell was then going big in the East. And I had my mind on doing Walter Winchell in the West. So I went back over to the head man of that of the NBC network in the West, a man named John Swallow. And I propositioned him. I said, look, you let me do these interviews every week. I'll write them. I'll get the stars who are to be guests. And I'll do them on the air for nothing, for free. Provided you let me write them my way, and provided I will be camaraderie with the stars. On the air, it'll be howdy Gene to Gene Harlow, and howdy Jimmy from Gene to me, and howdy Bing, and howdy Greta. And yes, I had Greta Garbo, the only person who ever had Garbo on the air. And I was to be always Jimmy to them. Well, naturally, the result of this was that very quickly, Jimmy Fiddler became a radio personality. It didn't take any time at all, because the program was popular. Well, I was doing these things, but not doing my gossip that I wanted to do. That was the thing I wanted to sell. I wanted to be the Winchell of the West. So I kept saying to Swallow every week, why don't you let me put gossip on you? And I'd take in stacks of letters from people who say, we enjoy your interviews, but tell us news about Hollywood. And out of the mail, and it was sometimes running as high as 2,000 and 2,500 letters a week, 50% of them wanted news about Hollywood. And John wanted to do it, but the East Coast said no. They were having enough trouble with Winchell, and they didn't want more of it in the West. Until one time, the orchestra leader on the show, who was a tippler, he liked to have the taste of the bottle before he went on, and quite often went on with a little too many tastes of the bottle. And on this particular occasion, he had really been at the bottle. And they didn't realize it until he went on the air, and it was too late then to do anything because his orchestra was playing the intros and the sags and so on. And he was missing his cues, and he came to the end of the show, at which time they ended with the orchestra playing Hollywood on the Air. A piece of music had been written for that show. And he missed his cue by 1 minute. He thought the thing was up and down, go off, and he went down 1 minute before they were to go off. The producer was up in the booth, and he didn't know what to do. He couldn't get down there in time, and there was a minute of silence because he was too drunk to realize what was happening. And wires came from the East as long as your arm. If this ever happens again, the whole show goes off the air. Swallow, you'll be fired. Everybody is out. And I took this occasion to go to John and said, look, John, I don't drink. I'm a teetotaler. And I'm always on the job. Now, you let me write you a couple of pages of one-line item, news. And let me use it at the end of the show. And I'll be there, and you stand at my elbow. And when you want me to stop, you touch me on the shoulder, and I'll finish that little item, which won't be more than 5 seconds long. They were all little short things. And you'll never go off the air wrong again. And that's how gossip was born. You did. And from then on, until that show, not until that show went off the air, but until I left that show to do something else, at the end of every show, it was Jimmy Fiddler's, sometimes it'd be 15 or 20 seconds of gossip, sometimes it'd stretch to a minute and a half. But I'd have enough to go 5 minutes if you wanted. And I, all this time now, when it was going on, I was trying to sell the idea to these Madison Avenue ad men who were coming out, advertising men. Couldn't get them, anybody to pay any attention to me until a young fella came out from the firm of Warwick Legler. There were three members of the firm. I forget the name, but Warwick is the name I'm interested in. The brother of the older Warwick came out to do some tie-ups for a product, some cosmetic. And I was the one going to help him get the stars for that show, which put me with him all the time. Well, all he talked about was dating young starlets. He was about my age. I wasn't married, and I had quite a list. Black book, they call it, of young starlets. And I got him dates. And all this time I'm saying to him, look, you're a man of 31 years old, 32 years old. You're a college graduate. You're interested in these stars and starlets. What do you think the little shop girl thinks about him? And I fed him so much of this that he went back and sold 15 minutes of Hollywood gossip to Tangy Lipstick. First time they'd been on the air. First time I'd been on the air. And I became a gossip columnist in the West Coast.
About what year was that?
This was about 1935, the latter part of 1935. And the reason I remember the date so well, of course, is that as a result of this, I became engaged to be married and sort of half-planned on a wedding date, but wasn't making enough money. I was only making $150 a week, which in radio wasn't much money. And I was planning on getting married when I... if I was successful and went up to higher money. Well, the program was pretty successful. It didn't get high ratings, but it evidently had a very loyal audience because right about the end of the 20 weeks that they were going to finish, they had a 20-week contract with me and with the network, I announced that I was going to be married. Told them. Agency and the sponsor and so on. So the agency came out with this great idea, which was that instead of giving Jimmy a wedding present, we're going to give all the listeners who will write in a card of congratulations to Jimmy one of our miracle sets, which
WBAI in New York
sold for a dime and had a sample of all their different products, lipstick and rouge and so on and so forth. Well, they got 245,000 answers to that one-time commercial. 245,000. And Variety had a headline. 1.5 rating draws 250,000 answers. Because 1.5 was my rating on the air at that time, which was not a big rating. But 245,000 answers was quite a response. Well, as a result of this, there were two results. First was, as a result of this headline, I guess, in the paper telling about it, I received a call from the William Morris Company, Bill Murray, who was then Mr. God in radio. He was the head man of their radio department. And anybody who wanted anything radio went to Bill Murray. Well, Murray called me on the phone and said, I was out here, said, who's your agent? And I said, I don't have one. He said, we'd like to handle you. And I said, well, I can't think of anything better than Morris and Murray handling me. And he said, when will you be in New York? And I said, tomorrow. And I wasn't going to be in New York tomorrow, but I was. So I went in and signed with him. And before I'll tell the other part of that story, I'll tell you that within no time at all, Murray had taken me into Luden's cough drops and had gotten me a new contract for $1,500 a week, where I'd been getting $150. And this was all on the strength of his power, of course, and the results from the other show. And it's from there that I went on to pretty good success as a radio man. Well, the second thing that happened, though, as a result of that big 245,000 answers was that Luden's Tangy had made up their minds that they were going to add 16 weeks to their 20 weeks, making a total of 26 weeks on the air. And then next fall, they were going to go on again with another 36-week contract. Well, as a result of this big number of answers, which required 245,000 miracle sets, which cost them $24,000, the company didn't have enough money to carry on the other 20 weeks, and I lost my 20 weeks. But, as I say, I got the other contract, which was a much bigger one. I offered to go back with Tangi for $1,000 a week, but they couldn't, they didn't have that kind of money. And I figured that I couldn't afford to go back for the $250 that they wanted to pay, or possibly $350 instead of $1,500. I just couldn't do that. I would have gone with $1,000 because I felt like I owed them my real break as a gossip columnist. But I couldn't drop from $1,500 to $350, and I think Bill Murray would have killed me if I had, so I wouldn't be here today.
Jimmy Fidler, you must have had an awful lot of people mad at you over the years of being a Hollywood gossip columnist, if you don't mind that name. Did they all get over it? Are they all friends again?
I think so. I think usually when I had the occasion to hammer something or criticize something or break a story they didn't want, I'd usually find ways later to say something nice. In other words, if I had an open letter to Constance Bennett, let us say, she once was going to sue me, but didn't. A couple of weeks later, I'd have something nice for Connie and maybe follow it up with something else so that she couldn't harbor resentment if I said how great she was in the next picture, and I wouldn't say it unless she was good. But if she was good, I'd go out of the way to say she was good. So, excuse me, Margaret. So, I don't think I ended up with many enemies. I had some. W.C. Fields never did like me, and the reason he didn't like me was quite amusing. Fields, as you know, was a very heavy drinker. Everybody knew it. And the studio especially knew it because he caused him a lot of trouble. So, he had gotten rather soggily drunk, and it was in ill health at one time. And the studio sent him up to one of the hot springs to thaw out. And they sent along with him two guards whom they were paying $75 a week to be with him night and day to see that he didn't drink. And every other day a doctor would go up and examine him and make sure he was all right. And well, I found out that he'd stand at the window and watch for the doctor to come. And when the doctor would come, he'd jovially speak to him and talk to him. And then the doctor would leave and he'd dash for the piano or over the bookcase, and he'd take out a bottle. He was paying the guards $150 a week not to report him. So the guards were collecting from both ends. Well, of course, this is a great story, and I had to break it. And he hated me from then on. He didn't like me worth a hoop.
Did you make any long-standing friendships with the stars?
Oh, yeah. I may have many, many friends in the industry. I'd hate to start now trying to enumerate them. A great many of them are gone, such as Clark Gable, for example, and, I could go right down the line. I have many friends from the stars. I don't believe I had any enemies. I think I had some people who had an antipathy for gossip columnists, and I always considered myself a gossip columnist. In fact, I can tell you something else why I say that. When I used to get laryngitis, which I could catch, you heard me coughing here a while ago, I'm very susceptible to changes in weather, and I'd get laryngitis and couldn't talk. And every once in a while, it happened maybe five or six times in my career, this would hit me at the time I was supposed to be on the air, and I'd have to get substitutes. Well, my substitutes, as a rule, were fast talkers. Harry Von Zell did a couple of them. Ken Niles did one or two of them. And I had fast talkers who could keep up my pace. But I got this sudden attack of laryngitis one Sunday morning it hit me, and none of these people that I'd been using were available. They were out of town or on something else, and I couldn't get them. And I got Truman Bradley to do my show for me that night, and Truman was one of the foremost announcers of the day. But he was a rich, beautiful speaker. He did the Ford Symphony Orchestra. He did the Philadelphia Philharmonic Orchestra narration. He had become NBC's big world news commentator on war affairs. This was during the war. And he had this beautiful, rich voice, and he could run off these Russian names that I couldn't pronounce by dividing them into syllables. And he'd just run them off like nothing. Well, he did my show that night, and I listened to it sitting in the hospital. I had my tonsils out the following day. He did my show that night, and I never heard anything so ridiculous in my life as this great, rich voice saying so-and-so was going to divorce, so-and-so was going to have a baby, and so on. It didn't fit, and I realized right then that my voice, especially pitched high and fast, was a gossip voice. And that's why it was successful in what it was doing where Truman Bradley would have failed overnight. And that was a gossip voice, and that's why I never worried about my voice from then on. I know I don't have a good voice, but I have a gossip voice.
It's a very distinctive voice. I think anyone would know it immediately.
It's gossip, it's clear and gossip.
Yeah. A number of years ago, during the 20s and 30s and 40s, when Hollywood was being run by a group of men, you know, the Mayers and the Goldwyns and the Coens, was there ever pressure brought on you to kill a story or to push a star or to say you liked a picture when you didn't?
Well, never pressure to kill a story that I ever remember, because they never knew what I was going to broadcast. Nobody knew what I was going to go on the air with except my own lawyers and the network lawyers who sat there with me and went over the copy. And since I'd had some study in law myself, I knew pretty well what I could and couldn't say and how to get around certain things. And I always had my proof when there was a story that I thought would be questioned. So consequently, there was nobody among the fathers-to-be of the studios who asked me not to do things because I didn't know what I was going to do. I was constantly asked to do things, to promote stars, to promote pictures. I was offered money many times to promote pictures. I was studios constantly invited me to write stories which they would buy for the screen. Now, they bought them from other columnists. I know of one powerful columnist who sold two or three stories to studios for many thousands of dollars. I know I was offered $10,000, and so I suppose this other columnist was offered that much or more. And the stories never were used. I don't think they were ever intended to be used, although the columnist may have written them in good faith. I don't know. I can't say. But to my mind, it was bribery, and I wasn't interested, and I was making enough money not to be interested, thank goodness. I'd hate to have faced him if I was broke. I might have changed my mind a bit. I don't know. But anyway, yes, I was often asked to use things, often asked to break things, often asked to promote young stars and starlets especially. And if it was possible, I would give cooperation. Now, you wonder about how studios gave me stories. And, of course, I could not use the press agent story as such because those stories were always full of goodies. How good our star was, how great she was.
Pop, in other words.
Yeah, pop. That's all it was. Pop. And I couldn't use it, but I would get from, we'll say, Warner Brothers Studio, a couple of nice, juicy blurbs about a 20th Century Fox star. And as a return, I would give that Warner Brothers Studio a little something that I wouldn't have given them otherwise.
That's called freebies in New York.
That's right. That's the freebies. They had something, silly-dilly, as we call them then. They'd swap us back and forth. Then the next day, maybe 20th Century Fox would give me a couple unwanted. And I got a lot of information this way. Excuse me for interrupting. I was one of the reporters who just went by and stopped in Brown. I got a lot of information this way, of course, and used what I wanted, which those studios didn't know I was getting and didn't know from where it came. However, getting back to our original answer that I was giving you, yes, studios ask cooperation. Yes, studios often barred me, but as I said just a few minutes ago, luckily for me, perhaps, although I say that with my tongue in my cheek, because when I was barred, that became a source of great information from other employees of the studio. They would give me in stories that I might not otherwise have gotten. So maybe if they had all barred me at once, I would have become the source of all information. Even Winchell couldn't have had anything. But none of them, I was never barred in any two at one time. Columbia barred me for a long time because I had had something about Harry Cohn. Oh, I know what it was. I'd had a story about Harry Cohn bumping a soldier from a plane in Dallas because Harry had to get back here for a picture. And they bumped a soldier off to make room for him. And to me, this was pretty bum business. It was during the war, and I broke it on the air. Well, I was barred for Columbia for months, but I still got lots of Columbia news. And eventually, I was barred, I suppose, from every studio at one time or another, because eventually I would say something that the studio boss didn't like, and the studio boss would do the barring. Stars couldn't bar me. They might be mad at me for a while, but they couldn't bar me. The studios could. Yes.
Yeah, there's a mystique to Hollywood. I think it's particularly prevalent in, among people who've never been out here. It's something I don't think most people can understand. The way business is done, the way careers and stars are made out here, it's different than New York. You must be aware of that. I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
It's more sudden than New York.
Yeah.
In New York, they work. You have to work to get anywhere. You very rarely does a girl come in from Podunk and a big producer, Merrick, for example, say, look, you're beautiful, you're going to star in my next picture, A Star Was Born.
Right, there's an
that
example.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
They pick people who have been there for a long time and who they know can handle the stage role. Now, they may pick a newcomer to be an understudy, which you know all about more than I do about that. But they won't pick a newcomer to become a star. Out here, a producer will become enamored of a girl, or will see a picture of her and she's beautiful in a magazine, or will see her do a guest shot on a television show, or in many ways they will become interested in that girl, and they'll make her a star overnight. They'll give her a star part. Now, they can do that, because if the girl is so awfully bad that they guess wrong, it's on film, and they don't have to use it. On the stage, if that actress goes on, she's a newcomer, and flops, she may ruin the play because they can't do it over again. She's been there. But in the movies, they can throw it out and put somebody else in. So it's different in that way. Of course, these people come from everywhere. They come from television these days, a lot of them. They come from little theaters, and there are a lot of those around Hollywood. Some of them come from the Actors Workshop. Both in New York and the West, they still are picked up on the streets or in parking lots. They picked up some kid the other day in a parking lot. I forget his name offhand, but that isn't important because nobody would know him yet anyway. But they gave him a pretty good part in the picture. This happens. No reason for it. I don't think there's any reason for it, except possibly a producer's ego. I think he maybe likes to take somebody new and build him. He likes to do Pygmalion, as it were. That's the only reason I can see, because why take a newcomer when here are 50 or 100 or 1,000 experienced boys or men just as fitting to the role as this newcomer, but experienced? Why not take them? One of them, but they don't. They take the newcomer. They take Lana Turner off a stool in a drugstore and a soda fountain of a drugstore and put her in a picture, and she does something sensational, in this case, not wear a bra, and she becomes a star.
Well, there's another thing, too. There's a theory that the people, even who have had great success in New York, have come out here and had tremendous personality changes and seldom for the better. Have you seen this?
Yes, I've seen it. Of course, you've got to think of two things. On the stage, personality is contained in two ways, acting ability and voice. Not appearance, because you can't see what they look like on the stage unless you're sitting down in an orchestra pit, you're sitting 10 rows back and you have a vague look at a face, but you don't know whether that face is really emoting, so showing sorrow or laughter, or you hear it, but you can't really tell unless you're right down in front that that face is exhibiting some emotion. On the screen, you're sitting right down in front. That face is right in front of you. And if it's exhibiting emotion, grief, but doesn't do it correctly, it becomes ludicrous, and you laugh at it. So that that is why I might say that they can pick people off stools and out of parking lots and put them on. They're looking at the personality. The acting ability is not nearly as important in motion pictures as it is on the stage in New York. We have great actors and great actresses who get bum roles in motion pictures, and they're not good. They just plain are not good. So the actor in motion pictures, he's got to have talent to be a Spencer Tracy, of course. But if he doesn't have a good story with it, he's not necessarily a great actor. We have just as great actors walking down the boulevard in Hollywood looking for jobs as we have stars who already have the jobs and are actors. But, again, I get back to acting for motion pictures. If they don't do the scene right, they'll shoot it again, and they'll shoot it again, and they'll shoot it again. John Stahl, directing a picture at Universal one time when I was sitting on the set, shot 26 times a scene of Adolph Monju walking out of a vestibule of a hotel and stepping into an automobile because he wanted to get a certain movement into that scene. No dialogue, no nothing. 26 times a man walking out of a vestibule and stepping into an automobile. Now, if it's an acting scene and the actor doesn't do it right, he doesn't say his line just right, they will shoot it over and over and over and over until he does do it right. So he doesn't have to be a great actor. He just has to be lucky enough to hit it one time out of 20. On the stage, you do it one time. If it isn't good, you've done it. It's bad. The critics come out and say he's lousy. Throw him out. Throw the show off the board.
There are also stories of great personal vendettas among studio executives and directors and producers against stars and vice versa. Do you know people who've had their... I'm not asking to name them, but other people who've had their careers ruined simply because they turned down an advance of a studio head or didn't get along with the wife of one of the executives?
Yes. Well, a lot of examples of that, as you say. I don't think it would be fair to mention names in that case. I'm glad you didn't ask. But I know of quite a few of those cases. I know of more cases where big stars knifed the back of lesser stars. That was more common, and it was generally because the big stars were jealous of the lesser stars, or the big stars had their eye on some man, or if it was a man, on some girl, and the lesser star was getting more attention than the big one was. Various reasons that there would be, as you call them, vendettas, crucifixions, or whatever you want to call them. I've known a lot of that. Everybody out here, whether they're reporters or not, know of those cases.
Now, the next one, I think it wouldn't be bad taste if I asked you to name it, but if you don't want to, you don't have to, naturally. But, other people who came out here, boys and girls from Broadway or from other places, who you really thought should have made it, who really had talent and drive and ambition and personality, and who didn't because they wouldn't play the game or had bad management?
I couldn't put my finger on any such case right now. I know a number of them who have come out and have done things and who were capable, but who, for one reason or another, didn't click with the cameras and consequently didn't get anywhere. But this was a fault of the cameras, let's call it, if you want to blame something or somebody. I don't offhand know of anybody who came out from the stage and failed to make good because of some other person stopping them or some producer or somebody stopping them. No, I don't. I know of some like Helen Hayes who came out years and years ago and did a picture and so disliked herself on the screen that she didn't need to be sent back. She went back of her own accord and said she would never do another motion picture, never come to the screen again. She has in much later years and has done some good things. But no, I can't tell you of a single person who I know came here to act and had talent and didn't get a chance to exhibit it. They all got chances to exhibit it. Now, if they didn't make good, Despite their talent, it was because of the camera.
In the days when the studios were run by moguls, the Mayers and Goldwyns and Schulbergs and so forth, do you think that they really exercised tremendous influence over the personal lives of their stars?
Oh, yes. Undoubtedly. Until stars were big enough and independent enough to say, no, you don't run my life. But we just had a very famous star of her day, Judy Garland. Her life was ruined. Now, not entirely by the way they say, but by the fact that she was in such a nervous state. She was a highly nervous woman, girl. She was like a cowed dog at times in the presence of the big moguls. I've seen her when I would think she was going to cry. I knew Judy Garland so well. I was on the set all the time. She and Margaret O'Brien were two of my favorite people, and I have gobs of pictures I had taken with them because I liked them so well. And they were as different as the day is long. Margaret was aggressive. Judy was just opposite. She may have had an inferiority complex, I don't know, but she was not aggressive. She was introspective, and she was made nervous by being bossed by LB. I've known of many cases where the stars were subdued and were afraid to move. On the other hand, I've known many like Garbo and Gable and Joan Crawford and Constance Bennett, who in their turn told off the big bosses and made it stick.
You mentioned you'd interviewed Garbo. Now, was that an interesting interview? You were the only one.
No, it wasn't interesting. Actually, it was a very dirty sort of affair. When I was doing those interviews, they weren't just straight interviews such as you and I are doing here and now. They might not have been as interesting as I think that you can make an interview with your questions. They were sort of playlists. One of them, for example, with Joan Blondell, she had gone fishing, and she was on the bank of the river and was casting her fish in her pole, that is, to catch a fish. And suddenly she got something, and she said to the Indian guy, "I've got one, I've got one." The Indian guy said, "That isn't a fish, it's an old automobile tire. It's a rug, it's some junk, it's Jimmy Fiddler." And Jimmy Fiddler had come up to catch her for an interview. So this is what the interviews were, the little playlist. Garbo did not speak English very well. She spoke English very poorly. At the time I had her, later on, I won't say she ever mastered it, but certainly she got so she could speak it. And it was a pretty dull affair, made big only by the fact that it was Garbo. And, of course, this was Garbo earlier in her career. This was when it was quite something to be on radio, to be invited to participate in radio. These stars weren't paid anything. Their pictures were plugged, but this was a big thing to the studios then. But, and Garbo was on to plug the picture she had done, a title of which escaped me. But the only reason she was on was to plug the picture. And as I say, if that did the picture any good, I'm a two-headed man.
Jimmy Fiddler's program isn't heard in New York. Where are some of the places one can hear it?
Just about anywhere.
Really?
Yeah, we're on 293 radio stations.
Do you ever sit around on cold, smoggy nights here in Hollywood and muse over what might have happened if you'd gotten better parts in silent movies years ago and you'd become Jimmy Fiddler movie star?
No, I haven't. As a matter of fact, I did two motion pictures later on.
Jimmy Fiddler, not as an
Jimmy
actor.
Fiddler. Well, not at that time I was James Marion. I used my middle name, which was Marion, because Fiddler didn't sound like a movie name. I did two pictures later on, and I don't think I was very good in them. Busby Berkeley was the director of both of them. Star Reporter was one, and it wasn't very good, but the other one was a pretty good picture called Garden of the Moon, and he directed that too. And thanks to him, I was able to stumble through a very wooden performance, but I could look at myself and see that it was just as well that I nearly starved in the old days. And I didn't miss it. One of the reasons I didn't miss it is I am, as you would guess, a highly nervous, energetic person. I can't sit. I don't sit and moan about not having made pictures because I don't sit long enough. I've always got to be doing something. I'll never retire. If the time comes when I can't talk anymore or I can't do what I'm doing, I'll be writing a book or I'll be doing something. I can't retire. I'm too nervous. But I quit pictures, actually, because I was too nervous to sit and wait for jobs. When I got one or two little things to do and they weren't important, I'd maybe wait for weeks before something else will come. And in addition to starving to death, I was soon in a highly nervous state. As I said to you a while ago, this wasn't my can of beans. I got one or two little parts, and the reason I got those actually was quite amusing. I had come out here from Memphis, Tennessee, and as I told you, I had been in the war. I wanted to come out and be an actor, but I stopped in Memphis on the way because that was my hometown. And I had some pictures taken by the local photographer, and I sent them into a contest being run by a magazine called Film Fund. Well, I couldn't wait for the contest to end. I came on out here, and I got registered with Central Casting, which was then where all the extras got their jobs through Central. And I had a distant relative who worked on a newspaper, and he said, these pictures you've got are no good. Have some new good pictures made professionally. So I went to a photographer out here, and with retouching and what have you, he made them look pretty good. So I sent these under the name of James Marion to the same magazine contest. Well, some 3 or 4 months later, the contest ended, and in the mail on the same day, I had a form letter which was sent to Memphis and redirected out here saying, sorry, everybody can't win. In the same mail, James Marion won the contest. It wasn't a beauty contest for the men. It was a personality and talent contest, of which I had neither. But he won the contest, and I always will, but it was because I was in Hollywood, because the winner got a trip to Hollywood.
Where?
I got a little part in Mark Zorro picture, and I followed that with a little part in Wally Reed picture, in which I played his brother. But it was after that that I nearly went to that.
We're nearly out of tape and time, so I'm going to say a very quick good night. I'm going to ask Jimmy Fiddler to end it in the way he's made famous for so many years, how he signs off. This is Richard Lamparski in North Hollywood. I've been talking with Mr. Jimmy Fiddler in his office. Thank you for listening. Mr. Fiddler, why don't you say goodnight?
Well, first, thank you, Richard, for this opportunity to talk to the people of your part of the country. And to all of you people listening, I want to say thank you, good luck to you, goodbye to you, and I do mean you.